So let's kick things off. Welcome to our remote podcast edition of First Name Basis. This is where we chat to special guests, industry leaders, and tribal scale employees so that we can have an authentic and informal conversation about a variety of relative tech and innovation topics. So I'm Ailsa Blair. I'm the design manager here at Tribal Scale. And we're chatting remotely with Kelly Small, who is creative director and author. Hey, Kelly.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me.
I'm pumped.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So do you want to introduce yourself a little bit and tell folks about you? They've already heard all about me, so they're bored of that now.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so yeah, I'm Kelly Small. I am a creative director currently for a little digital agency called Grass Riots. I am coming from the for-profit world, and we exclusively work with nonprofit, progressive nonprofit clients now, which is awesome. Super excited about that. We'll get more into my history, but long story short, I come from the for-profit world, had a big burnout, got out of Dodge, rethought everything, and embarked on this big research project that resulted in my book that is called The Conscious Creative, mm-hmm. Practical Ethics for Purposeful Work. And so that's kind of what we're here to talk about today. I'm really excited about being sort of at this place in the journey that I've been on. So I'm excited to look back a little with you folks and talk about it.
Yeah. How long have you actually been writing the book now? It must be a while, eh?
Oh my God. It's a good question. I think the book was conceived in a walk down the street in Vancouver that I was having with my partner in like 2017, probably. And then from there, I was able to convince I was in grad school at the time, I was able to convince the school to let me write a book for my Master of Design degree, and that's where the research kicked off from there. Yeah. And so it's been an ongoing process, and we actually just went to print, like, last week, which is wild. I don't even know what to do without this project on my plate. So needing some new research projects, but really, really pumped about this.
Yeah, that's so great. When does it officially come out?
So the book launches on August 4th, okay. But it's available right now for pre-order, which as it turns out, I'm learning all of these things now, is really great for authors and for publishing houses to just sort of gauge how much interest there is. So if anybody wants to pre-order, I'm not going to turn that down.
I definitely already pre-ordered it, so I definitely advise everyone else go out and do it.
You're amazing. Thank you.
Amazon's great in some ways, not everywhere.
It's a whole other conversation, isn't it?
Oh, it is. It is. I'm sure we will touch on supporting, it at some point.
Yeah, you're supporting small creators with this beast. So, I mean, the other thing, you know, I will say, I think that is important, is the book is available for pre-order from almost every independent bookstore out there.
Oh, great.
So, like, Another Story, for example, here in Toronto is a great place that you can just call them and order it. They'll get it for you. And so you are definitely able to get it in some non-Amazon, non-Indigo spots, but the big folks are there as well. And it all helps, but just going to drop that there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think House of Anansi Press, who you're publishing with, they have their own bookstore, which I believe is now reopened, so folks can pick up some curbside pickup orders.
Yes.
So you can always order it, I'm sure, directly through them, which is pretty cool.
Yep. Once it comes out on August 4th, they'll be able to go straight to the Anansi site or go to the bookstore to grab it.
Nice. Okay, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the motivation to write the book and kind of what led to that moment in Vancouver while you were walking down the street with your partner, just kind of making that realization?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I get it a lot, and I never know where to start, because I think the real story starts so young. But in terms of what really motivated me to write the book, creative director in advertising, I was working for a ton of big brands, ton of clients that I really struggled with from an ethical perspective. I mean, not only is, you know, advertising, of course, problematic because it was really my job to like strategically motivate millions of people to buy stuff that they don't need, you know, contributing to things like climate change and things like child labor in certain cases and like some really, really horrible stuff. There's of course that, which was really, really weighing on me. And then there were, you know, the day-to-day stuff that was really explicit. So I was working on this sunscreen brand. It's a big name sunscreen brand you can buy everywhere. And it turned out that summer that whatever it was in the formula was so, it was flammable and people's skin was actually, they were catching on fire if they got even close to a flame.
Damn.
Which is wild. And so, you know, I hate to say it, but I continued working on the brand. I didn't feel like I had a choice. That was my job. And it was our job to work along with PR to try to, you know, resolve the issues from the perspective of making the brand palatable and lovable again. And that was a really, really hard one for me. And it stands out in my mind as a situation where I really hit a wall and was like, how much longer can I do this? I worked for a big box international superstore for a while, and I was at their compound, and it was right around the time that, I think it was around 2015, that the Bangladeshi factory collapsed, and they found that some very well-known clothing lines from this store were being made there. So okay. I was at the compound, I was talking to my client, and my client made a joke about it.
Oh,
and
God.
It just became clear to me that there was no there were just no sort of values driven conversations happening in that space. That was really hard. And on top of that, like long hours, aggressive environments, unrealistic expectations about availability. I found the world to be really ableist, and you know, we're also faced with like constant microaggressions for those of us who like fall outside of the category of being a cishet man. You know, I remember walking down the hallway when I was quite young, and the partner of the company followed me with his eyes, and he was talking to his colleague and turned to his friend and was like, "She's pretty cute, eh?" And the other guy was like, "Oh yeah, ha, ha, ha." And he was like, "For a lesbian." And like, it just, these are the things that like were
yeah.
just happening so commonly and were so expected. All of this to say, eventually I hit a wall and I got really sick, and I said I couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't do it anymore. My mental health was really suffering, and I decided to go off to grad school, and I asked the question, like, is it even possible to work in a capitalist system and realize an ethical practice at the same time? And so I dedicated my thesis research to that. And the book is the culmination of all of that research. It's somewhere around 100 actions for ethical practice and incremental change that we can make within problematic systems.
Right.
Yeah, hopefully that gives you a pretty good idea of sort of where it came from and some of the motivations.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing, actually. And I have definitely hit some of those situations, multiple of those situations throughout my career, as I'm sure you have. So I'm definitely on board with, you know, making sure that we're ethical about what we're doing, kind of focusing on inclusivity, as well as making sure that we're always just being very conscious and aware and empathetic about the actions that we take and the consequences that happen to the larger audience. Without spoiling your entire book, what advice would you give to your younger self in that situation now after writing the book?
Oh my God, that's a great question. I would tell young me to stop thinking about absolute notions of good and bad and right and wrong, and try and find a more dialectical way of thinking, and understand that ethical practice and problematic systems can coexist, and they must coexist. We're not going to, you know, single-handedly overthrow the dominant economic system. That's for sure not going to happen. But what we can do is continue to work and subvert from within, and defining our hard no, which is one of the actions in the book, you know, really taking a stand against what we, in terms of what we will and will not work on. And I think I would just, well, I would tell me to read the book because I wrote it for myself. Like I really did. I wrote it for, like, you know, maybe 8 years ago, me as a creative director in that space, who was like, I had these values that were completely extricated from my professional life, and I didn't know what to do about it. I didn't know where to start. And this book is really, it's that starting place. It's that, like, here are, like, a couple of ideas that you can implement immediately. Here are some bigger ideas that you can park and work toward as you educate yourself, learn, listen more. And yeah. So I told myself to read the book. Like, future you did a cool thing.
Yeah,
go totally. Check it out.
Absolutely. Yeah. And no, I think it's going to be really important for a lot of folks kind of graduating and coming into the industry now, particularly where we're at politically and economically. I think it's very well timed, almost.
It feels like it. And you know, there's always a worry when you're writing something like this, where you're talking about issues of, like, social justice and climate action and all, like, things are changing so rapidly. And I am really grateful that it will contribute to the discourse that's happening in the world right now, hopefully in a positive way. It is in no way the be all end all. And it is humble and, you know, small incremental changes. And I don't even like the term, like, thought leader or expert. I'm another person who is out there, like, trying to learn and trying to sort of live the best I can within all of this, everything that's swirling around us. And this is my small contribution to this zeitgeist right now, you know?
Yeah, I know you say small contribution, but I have every faith it's going to be a lot larger than that.
Oh, thank you.
I know that it's something that I've been struggling with throughout my entire career as well, right? Is having that balance of, you know, morality versus the need to be able to earn money and live in this capitalistic society, which makes things really, really hard. I know that we have very similar politics, so this is going to be a very easy discussion. But given the Black Lives Matter movement and where we are right now with social justice, how can you see us, like, moving forward from this within the creative industry to make sure that we're supporting that in the best way?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really big question, and it's one that I want to, like, caveat my response with. Again, not being an expert, I don't have the authority to speak on behalf of the Black community, obviously. Right. From my perspective, the creative industry, you know, needs to listen more, needs to read more, needs to actually commit to actionable change as it relates to inclusive design and actually changing the makeups of our senior leadership. Like, it's trending on Twitter right now, this idea that you've got all of these corporations all over the world sharing their so-called solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, and folks are sharing screenshots of all white boards, right? And all white C-suites. And the reality is there's only so committed to this cause that you are if you're not even including the right people in the major decision-making that's happening in your company. And so, I mean, I think, like, from a business perspective, that's the sort of obvious that I go to today, especially because I think it's top of mind because it's been trending this morning. And I think, you know, designers talk a lot about empathy. Designers talk a lot about human-centeredness. designers talk about a lot about like universal design and inclusive design methods. And, you know, I think we risk being a bit performative with those words in the same way that I think we risk being a bit performative in the way that we share information about this movement. And so I think it's up to all of us, and I'm really trying to live this, to take deeper action and really ask ourselves and ask like how we can actually affect change. And sometimes I think that just means like having more of the hard conversations with the folks in your life whose you know politics really differ from your own and beyond. You know, I think I'll leave it there. But I think my biggest hope is that we start to see change at the senior leadership, C-suite, and board level of leadership.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think there are a lot of buzzwords that we use in this community and in this industry, like you say, human-centered design, universal design, like inclusive design. Like we throw these terms around a lot. And I think whilst we mean well, we don't necessarily put our actions where those words are. We are not necessarily including a range of users when we're doing our research, you know, making sure that we're getting input from the entire community. For the most part, I think we end up very much focusing within our own niche kind of area of what's comfortable, which is unfortunately usually white folks, and getting opinions that then drive design that is just designed for white folks. So how can we make sure that we're bringing kind of true inclusivity in those early actions to make sure that the tech we're creating is inclusive, is not harmful to any community? Because I've also seen a lot of conversations on Twitter this week about the harm that our our community and industry of tech is actually doing. You know, thinking about, without calling anyone out too hard, but the fact that Breitbart still has a store that is supported by a major tech company is wild to me.
It really is shocking.
Especially when said tech company came out this week and said that it was donating $1 million to different charities to help on the ground right now. I think whilst that's all well and good and yay for kind of helping folks with their bail funds, the harm you're doing by hosting that store far outweighs the money you're donating to those nonprofits. So how can we look inwards and make those good decisions and actually the hard decisions, which are, this is not good for us as, you know, a society. We need to make a strong decision and action it.
Agreed. Yeah, it was a good rant. You had a question in there that was looking at universal and inclusive design and like how we can sort of ensure that we're actually like living that. And I remember reading an interesting article that looked at the differences between universal and inclusive design. And universal design is of course like design that is intended to be as accessible to like the maximum number of people, and whereas it's a result, whereas inclusive design is a process. And so I think we have to commit to the true leveled playing field of inclusive design that includes an incredibly diverse set of stakeholders and decision makers in that whole design process, and really make sure that we are paying very special attention, very close attention to power dynamics within that space. Vivian Castillo talks a lot about this and power dynamics, and you know, the designer's role is often one as facilitator. And so I think it's really important for us to watch and like see who's dominating the conversation and see how we can work a little bit harder to make sure that like all of the voices are heard and that nobody's steamrolling each other. And if we do find that maybe microaggressions are occurring, to call it out. It happened at work for us yesterday, actually, on a management meeting. And one of my colleagues was brave enough to say, "Hey, everybody, stop. I'm witnessing some microaggressions happening right now, and I want us all to just like stop and feel the discomfort." And we did. An amazing conversation came out of it, and it was incredibly uncomfortable. Oh my God, it was uncomfortable.
I can imagine.
But I feel like so much closer to everybody as a result. We supported the people who we should have been supporting, and we learned valuable lessons. And we've all got to stay vocal, you know. Don't just like, you know, let these things slip and cringe to yourself quietly. Like, those days are over. Say the thing, name it. That's where we are now. And I think, I mean, it's a small, simple action that can make a lot of difference. And I think that's also how we find our allies.
Yeah. And I think as well, like, that is an amazing example of how I think we should feel those moments and how we should be in them all together, feeling that discomfort. I think as white folks, we're very adverse to that discomfort, and we don't like being called out for, you know, those instances of privilege and entitlement that are baked into us. But it's really important for us to unlearn that behavior so that we can truly be inclusive, and so that we can make sure that we're not putting harm into the world with the things that we do.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is a really tough thing to do. No one likes to look inward and think, oh, this thing that I have predominantly known since childhood actually has a lot of systematic racist undertones or overtones. Yeah,
this is it. It's like, I hear so often from white folks that it's like, but I'm not racist, but I want equality. And, are sort of like they're centering themselves by doing that. And I'm working really hard to decenter myself in like all of these conversations. And I think we just have to be really cautious about understanding that like ourselves and our families as white folks are completely complicit in all of these like white supremacist systems, super problematic systems that continue to this day. And just because you have some intentionality in your heart, which is fantastic, doesn't mean that you are exempt from all of that. Yeah, paying special attention to the moments where, you know, we're getting called out or we're feeling like significant discomfort around a defensiveness and saying like, but I'm not racist. But I, you know, anytime there's that discomfort, that is your cue to stop and look inward and like really try and flesh out what's going on for you. And I think there's a lot to be learned for all of us by doing that.
Yeah, and intent does not equal impact, right? And I think the biggest learn for a lot of folks, and probably the first part of getting into this process, is just to stop in those moments and listen. Listen to the lived experiences of folks around you that you might not have been aware of before. Take that all in. Be prepared to say, okay, I thought I was right. As it turns out, I'm actually going to look inward and take that on board. I'm sorry, you know? And that's all it takes. It doesn't have to be this argument where we start getting defensive and it becomes, you know, aggressive or just even more of an aggression for the person on the other end of that discussion. I think that if we can take that step backwards and stop and admit when we're wrong, that is half the battle. And, you know, it boggles my mind sometimes that people are so unwilling to do that. But here we are, and hopefully it starts to change a little bit now.
I hope so. And I wanna plug a couple of not me books as well. Yeah. Like The Skin We're In, Desmond Cole, yes. White Fragility, Critical, and How to Be an Anti-Racist are great books and like imperative reading right now.
Yeah, go read them for sure. And you mentioned Viviane Castillo a little bit earlier. I had the pleasure of seeing her actually talk at the first UXR conference that was here.
Oh, nice.
Which was wonderful. It was about the role of shame in UX research and how we carry that. I highly recommend that everyone check that video out. I know it's on YouTube. I have shown it to my design team before, who also loved it. And it has a lot of practical ways that we can start implementing that in our day-to-day as creatives, as designers. But she also shared a bunch of self kind of help resources for white folks that if you can track down, and maybe we can link to at the bottom of this video and kind of audio, but they are super, super helpful to begin to think about.
I actually have that document from her because I interviewed her for the book. She features in it, as do you, which I'm very grateful for. I'll track down that Google Doc. We'll put it up for folks. It's an amazing resource for white folks to really like look at their own practices and start with themselves. I mean, that's the first section of my book as well is the personal actions that can be taken before getting into like the outward facing social actions or the environmental actions or the economic actions. We have to start there and really start to like question ourselves.
So we've talked a little bit about the changes that we can make as individuals to make this industry better. How do you think that we can start to impact the bigger picture that's here, the way that we approach design, the way that our boards are made up? What little things do you think that we can start doing to make sure that that changes for the better in the future?
That is a great question. And admittedly, I don't even know where to start with that question. I'm going to have to think about that. There are so many layers to that. I could really start anywhere. So, I mean, one of the things that is in the book, one of the actions is to advocate for living wages.
Right.
One of our biggest issues, of course, is the fact that we have folks in this society who are working full-time jobs, who basically can't afford to pay rent and also feed their families. It's abysmal and disgusting. And so advocacy, of course, being very vocal, participating in whatever sort of level of advocacy or activism folks are comfortable with, while of course taking care of themselves, because self-care is extremely important. You're not going to be able to help anybody else if you're not okay. One of the actions is also to redefine bottom line ambitions. You know, I think, and this one really resonates with me because I am I was sort of raised and socialized to believe that my worth and professional success was directly related to the size of my salary and my title, right? And so I spent a lot of time in my early professional life like chasing that money and chasing that title. And the reality is it kind of just got me trapped somewhere. And so, I know we're not supposed to talk about money, but I make significantly less money than I used to. You know, even I make less money than I did 10 years ago. And I am happier. I am surrounded by better people. I've made some amazing friends in the marketing world who are lifelong friends and are incredible folks. But just on the whole, I'm surrounded by more like values-driven people and people who are really committed to like doing the work. And I think if every one of us redefined our bottom line ambitions and chose to make less in order to do more, it would really shift the culture of work. I could go on forever about like shifting the culture of work. Even if we want to talk about ableism and accessibility in the book, right. And am going to be doing a talk fairly soon at OCAD, I think, about the sort of redefined post-pandemic working world and how, you know, you and I right now are able to meet, even though we're in the same city,
yeah,
this way, instead of sitting in the same room, which as an introvert, as someone with significant anxiety that I'm, yeah, you know, not ashamed to share, I don't know if I would be doing the same level of like publicity and like sharing my story and sharing the book if we weren't in the space where it's like all of these things that folks with disabilities have been asking for forever, a little bit more leeway on, you know, not having to do those long commutes, the long working hours away from home, the fluorescent lights, the you know, even just like inaccessible working spaces, like all of these things are, there's this like opportunity in the air right now for us to really look at the opportunities, I think, that are coming out of this like post-pandemic world, and design a new way forward for all of us, and perhaps a working world that is more inclusive and accessible to everyone. So that's another one. There are so many. I could go to so many places with this. I mean, and of course, caveat with the with talking about the opportunities in the post-pandemic world. I say that with like the utmost, like that, like a heavy heart and of course, deep acknowledgement of the losses that have occurred and the inequities that and the cracks in the system that have been exposed and the folks who have really been disproportionately impacted by those.
Yeah, and we are very, very privileged in the way that we get to meet like this, that we have jobs, yeah, that we can do to work from home. You know, I know from experience, I also suffer from great anxiety and depression, which I talk about a lot very openly. And so I'm definitely with you sometimes on just having to shut people out and just focus in on my own space a little bit. And I think that a lot of folks who need that accessibility have been told for a really long time that it's not possible to accommodate them. That, you know, it's not going to work, collaboration's going to be off. And I think the one good thing that I've seen to come out of this is even Sheetal, our CEO, who wasn't a big fan of remote working before because he likes to be in the office and he likes to be with people, has now said, you know, remote work is actually working really well for us. We're actually really highly functional right now as a company. You know, we've kind of gone to that remote life pretty easily, and our collaboration is still the same that it ever was. So there is opportunity there for us to be able to support people who need those accommodations. We just have to be willing to do the work. And it sucks that it takes a global pandemic and for us, you know, for the most part, able-bodied folks having to work in this situation for people with disabilities to be accommodated like this.
Yep, agreed. It always seems to take like a crisis for, and I know, I mean, Naomi Klein, of course, always talks about like disaster capitalism and like coronavirus capitalism and the ways that crisis, you always see some of the big evils, we'll call them, like exploiting crisis, but yeah. Also she talks a lot about the opportunity within crisis and how all of a sudden all of this money is freed up to support people. It's yep. Like people are getting more money with CERB right now than like folks on disability have been getting forever. Where did it all come from? How come this is suddenly available? So we're all seeing things a little bit different and differently. And I really hope that we don't lose that. A great organization is Naomi Klein's foundation called The Leap. And oh, cool. They're really advocating hard for things like living wages and housing and just a much more equitable way forward. So I highly suggest everyone go and follow them. They've got really great resources.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, I will definitely check that out for sure. Yeah, so I guess to take us off the track of talking about these giant societal issues and systematic yeah. issues that we don't have much control over, given that, you know, we are but designers living in this world.
Yes, exactly.
What is next for you post-launch of the book? What do you think that your next steps are going to be?
That's a fun question. Yeah. What I want my next steps to be, it's really interesting. In writing this book, I feel like I've learned so much from this research process, and I'm a completely different person with much more like radical politics than I had when I started. And so I wonder if there is an opportunity for like a second edition of the book or like a continuation, even like just a new book sort of on the back of this that like continues that journey. And it's something that I was actually having a conversation with the CEO of our company this morning about, is that everyone's at a different place on their journey. And so many of us share this desire to work more ethically, to do better by each other, by the world, by ourselves. And I think it's really important that we respect everybody's spot along that continuum, you know? And I think the conscious creative is a great starting place for someone who is in industry, wants to do better, wants those, you know, small incremental changes that they can make, you know, implementing immediately. And perhaps the future book is something that like it continues with us as we all progress on that continuum toward, I don't know if that's toward more radical politics or exactly what it is, but the point is I loved writing the book. It yeah. has been an absolute dream come true. I am grateful every day for the privilege to have been able to take a break from my time in industry, go back to school, write. I spent a lot of very quiet time alone. I did a lot of yoga and yeah, it was a tremendous privilege and was the best thing I could do for my mental health out of what was really like a mental health crisis. And so I hope for more of that. And I hope also that I'm able to continue having these conversations, you know, with folks. And I love my job. I love the fact that I'm contributing to, you know, fundraising for some great organizations, and I'm surrounded by a lot of folks who are really challenging me to think differently. So yeah, let's hope it's, I'm pretty happy right now. I'm very Good. Grateful to say, because it hasn't always been that way, but that like it's, you know, it just continues that I get to write more, keep doing what I'm doing, and like continue to learn.
That's awesome. Yeah, I hope so too. I definitely hope that it is more radical politics that we're moving towards, but I yeah. know you know that about me already.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tough, right? It's tough to kind of go through that, and I'm sorry you had to go through that mental health crisis to get to this point. But I think that, at least from my experience, anytime that I've gone through that, those troubling times are really sucky and they're really horrible in the moment. But when you look back on them, sometimes the greatest things come out of them afterwards. And so I'm really glad that you had that opportunity to kind of write this book out of that really hard situation for yourself.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's, I look back and, you know, remember some really like bleak, really bleak times where, and the juxtaposition between where I was in this like place of hopelessness and where I am now, where I mean, even the world, like we're seeing so much like uprising and this opportunity for revolution, and it's just there's so much darkness and heaviness and sadness in the world, and also coexisting with that, I see a lot of optimism and huge opportunity for revolutionary change, and I'm just like cheering folks on and like, you know, really just trying to stay hopeful.
Yeah, and I know you well enough to know that those positive things are probably making you very happy right now, like they are with me. It's been a long time coming for these conversations to be a lot more prevalent. Sure. So I'm glad we're there. I am really upset and regretful that we have had to, well, the Black community especially has had to go through as much as it has to get to this
point. Oh my God, yes.
It should not take, you know, centuries of this to get to this point. So I'm glad that we're at a turning point. I hope that we can bring about change that will really revolutionize our industry, especially in tech, because I don't think we think about these things and the harmful actions that we're taking by building certain pieces of technology. So hopefully that is something that we start to talk about more as we move forward as a society.
I certainly hope so. And I really, really hope, again, like, to use your words without calling anybody out too hard right now, that like big tech starts taking a bigger stand. Actually, why not call people out? Like Snapchat has taken a stand. Facebook has not. They're still, perpetuating and sharing and allowing white supremacist content across their site, hate speech. It's pretty shocking, given what's going on in the world, that this notion of free speech is somehow taking priority over lives, over real lives. So
yeah. There is definitely a lot of real technological evil out there. I mean, we touched on Amazon a little bit, kind of coming into this and the harm that they are doing for, you know, warehouse workers especially, and the fact that they're not getting the right precautions to deal with COVID. Generally, just the way that Amazon is run, very problematic. But also, like, I want to take the time to call out a couple of folks that I have seen doing things pretty well, which Ben and Jerry's, apparently a very longtime supporter of the Black community, and released a wonderful statement that I read, I think, yesterday, which I encourage everyone to go read before they release their own statements.
Oh, it was incredible. Like, there was no room for anybody to say, oh, that was diplomatic. Like, they said, nope, fuck this. We are against this. And really, and we know there's action behind it as well, which is so incredibly important. We had a big conversation at work about this yesterday and how they are all in one way or another extremely performative, and also there is a benefit to it.
Yeah, no, I think Ben and Jerry's did an incredible job. Lego as well, I think, also did an incredible job. I don't know if you've taken a look at their statement, but it was also pretty good.
Yeah, and they've stopped promoting any of their sets that have police in them. Law enforcement.
They completely recalled their entire law enforcement line, which is incredible.
Amazing.
Like, and that's the kind of change that is going to take us forward, right? Is being able to listen to people saying, we don't trust police officers because they target minorities. Okay, maybe we take these off the shelves so they're not as triggering to minorities. Maybe we kind of create more inclusive sets that will work for everyone beyond just the white folks who are going to buy them. And yeah, if anyone else has any really awesome companies that have released statements or have been kind of supporting minority I guess, communities long-term, please drop them in the comments. I would love to find some more of those and support them in any way I can.
Yeah, please. Sort of speaking about like statements and bringing it back to like the power of design, and I've definitely been sort of like 1 foot in tech, 1 foot more in like communication design and like marketing and advertising. And on the communication design or information design front, I saw this amazing piece of content, and I'll share it with you afterwards, that took like, what's beautiful about design is this our ability to envision a future that doesn't exist yet, of course, right?
Yes.
And so it's the difference between, I'm seeing a lot of hashtags, equally important, saying abolish police. And also this artist came out with these, it was like this vision for the future. And instead of just sort of making a statement with very little context, these cards were beautifully designed. They were very welcoming and vibrant and outlined a new way of thinking whereby, you know, instead of if say your friend is having a mental health crisis, they have gotten violent, imagine calling like 311 and all of a sudden a mental health support team shows up at your door, de-escalates. And it goes through all of these different scenarios that like in our current society, we're calling on law enforcement. And these are folks who are like, closer to like military training than like real mental health and de-escalation and like psychology and like supporting folks who are clearly in crisis in all of these situations. And yeah, it's imagining this, this new world where we redesign this notion of law enforcement. As more of a public care sort of thing. And so again, it's just, I thought that was a really interesting sort of example of like a simple, the power of design to help change minds by presenting information in a new way.
Yeah, and I think that's amazing. And I think that it speaks to the fact that we have a lot of control about what the future looks like from this industry. You know, tech is used by everyone every day. We're all on our phones, full stop. You know, I have a Google Home in my home. I'm sure most people do as well. Yeah. we have all this tech. How can we ensure that when we're working on these projects, that what we're creating is not doing harm at the end of the day, that it's actually helping to push these conversations, that it's helping to include everyone. And yeah, I think it's a really big conversation that we're probably going to have to get into as an industry and a community a lot more in the coming months, years, probably decades. But I'm really glad that it's starting now. And I hope that we all start to become a little bit more aware when we're working on those things and we're making the small decisions about how UI looks or how the UX looks, that we're being more inclusive, we're being more future thinking and just really being proud of what we're creating instead of creating something that is going to put harm into the world.
Yeah, for sure. And while I was writing the book, and I talk about this a little bit in the book as well, is I did some research into the philosophy of technology and the way that, you know, technology is a bit of a Faustian bargain, that it, like, technology giveth and technology taketh away, design giveth, design taketh away, like, for every new advantage, a new technology offers, there's this host of unconsidered societal changes and effects. That is a bit of a paraphrase from a guy who I would consider a bit of a tech prophet, like an early tech prophet named Neil Postman. And he died in 2003. But if you go and read his work, which I reference a few times in the book, he basically, he imagined like the social world as it exists today and the ramifications that would come of this. And it's really, really fascinating. And I think there's a lot to be gleaned, a lot of insight to be gleaned for those of us in tech now to look back and learn from history, even with the advent of TV, the internet itself, all of these things. Like, there's a lot written about it that I actually didn't know existed. I was really not familiar with this whole like space of research in the philosophy of technology, and like there are some brilliant people like thinking and talking in that space who have been for like decades. It's anyway, just drop that there. I feel like the viewership or the listeners here would probably be interested in checking that out if they haven't already.
Yeah, I haven't read any of his work, but based on that recommendation, I will definitely go check it out.
Awesome.
Cool. So we are running out of time. So I just wanted to give you the ability to shout out your book again.
Thank you. Yeah, it would be amazing if folks want to check out The Conscious Creative. It is available at all of your local indie bookstores. So that's the first place I would suggest that you pick it up. But it's also, of course, available on Amazon and Indigo and Barnes & Noble in the U.S. They sold international rights greatly, so it's available most places. Yay. And yeah, check it out if you're interested in shifting your career,
awesome,
based work into what you do and ethics, then this is a book for you.
That's great. Yeah, and I would highly recommend that everyone go and pick that up. I am super excited to read it when it comes out, Kelly, so I can't wait.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, and for all the listeners, you can check out this podcast and all the rest of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and also on YouTube, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again, Kelly, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to kind of join us and talk about all things design and politics and systematic issues that we have touched upon today.
Some heavy topics today, definitely. But it was fun. It was a good conversation. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super grateful for this platform and to be able to share my work a little bit more widely. So thanks to everybody who listened, and thanks, Ailsa, for having me.
Yeah, anytime, Kelly. So this has been First Name Basis, the remote edition. Thanks, everyone, and we will check you out next time. All right, bye.